Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
It's The Wonky Show. Looks like an autumn election is in the offing. We'll look ahead to that. We've got new stuff out on sleep. We'll pick that up and we'll share thoughts from Helsinki. It's all coming up.
Notwithstanding, you know, we've spoken about the general election and all that sort of stuff. We're doing pretty well in the UK. We are a Broadway musical. But acting like we're a horrible fire.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly round to this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, live from Helsinki in Finland, where 40 students' union officers and staff have been touring students' nations, unions, universities and even the odd fraternity to learn more about representation and student life. So here to tell us more, as usual, three terrific guests. Lily Byrne is President of Sheffield Students' Union. Lily, your highlight of the trip, please.
I think it's got to be the sense of overalls and a true passion for them in Finland. I think everybody's a bit addicted to them. The sense of identity, everybody's got the colour coordination between generations. I'm kind of jealous. I'd like a pair.
More on the overalls later. Hannah Clark is VP Activities at Lincoln SU. Hannah, your highlight of the trip, please.
Absolutely has to be taking a dip in a freezing cold lake and sitting in a sauna with too many CEOs for my liking.
It's not all work, work, work. And Gary Hughes is Chief Exec at Durham Students' Union. Gary, your highlight of the trip, please.
Yeah, it wasn't overalls and I refused the sauna. I think my highlight, generally, it's just great after a difficult year to be out with meeting so many enthusiastic people who tell stories about how they love their university and their country and they're doing it for the good of society. It gives you hope.
Yes, now great. More on that later. Now, first of all, we start this week with the year ahead, Gary.
Yes. The worst kept secret in showbiz is that George Osborne tells us that an election is November the 14th. It's a secret that none of us could have guessed, but it does mean that all the policy stars are going to align in the next couple of months. And we're going to have to make some choices, get some priorities and pick our poison.
Yes. Now, yeah, it's going to be quite a year. So look, as it stands, Lily, there is nothing from any of the major political parties really at all on students, is there? We've got no sense of what there might be nothing in the manifestos for students.
Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a loss of identity, I think, and a loss of hope from all the student populations. We've heard nothing and had a little feedback from local MPs as well. So I think everyone's a little bit down in the run-up to the next general election.
Yeah. What do we do about this, Hannah? What do we do? I mean, you know, there should be. There should be a youth and student agenda, shouldn't there?
Yeah, there absolutely should be. I think, particularly following COVID, I know it's all over everything, but cost of living and housing is absolutely should be on the agenda. And it's something that we've heard not a lot about in regards to students. So that's something that absolutely needs to be focused on going forwards.
Gary, how have we got ourselves into a position where this close to an election, there appears to be pretty much no retail offer for anyone under 40.
I think you go where the votes are, don't you? The analysis of all party leaders is that the demographic that turns out to vote that needs their interests catered for are people who have mortgages, who have children, who are struggling, and they need a retail offer. People who are less inclined to vote, who are not paying tax in the same way, are just not the priority. I think there's something about geographical distribution and actually thinking about protecting or hunting whatever wall of whatever colour you're after at any time. So I think the point I'm making familiar is I think that the two main parties are a bit silent. We've got to remember that the other parties are actually trying to fill the space. Mm-hmm. Because to be honest, what other space can they fill? I think the agendas, if we look in Scotland, if we look from the Greens a little bit, if we look from the Lib Dems, there's a little bit there. You've got to realise it's a two-horse race, isn't it?
Yeah. But Lily, am I being naive here, right? So I don't know. And sometimes talking about policy areas and parts of the population is difficult for politicians, right? Mm-hmm. But isn't there, shouldn't politicians, leaders of political parties, feel a sense of duty towards talking to large chunks of the population. Like, we surely aren't going to get to September, November with nothing really in the manifesto on housing, intergenerational fairness, you know, student finance. Are we, like, could that happen, do you think?
You'd think, you would hope that they'd actually listen to this massive cohort of people. If they were starting to ignore the over 60s, everyone would be a little bit concerned, but they should be seeing the student population, whatever age that might be and whatever demographic, as the hope for the future. And I don't think they're seeing it as that progression, and they're not putting enough support into it to see the potential it could be in the future.
But do you think that, do you think some of that might be the kind of, you know, the Starmer pushback against the youth quake? Because, you know, I mean, there was this sense, wasn't there, that wherever Corbyn went, he was surrounded by lots of young people. Mm-hmm. Do you think, you know, some of it might be a kind of, well, we're just not going to do what Corbyn did?
And I think Corbyn continues to be surrounded by the youth at the moment. But I'll be honest, I think that they're just running away from it. And I think we're getting this leaning towards right-wing rhetoric in all of UK democracy at the moment. And they're going where they think the votes are going to go. But at the moment, there just needs to be a massive push of the youth and the young voters in the next turnout. And I'm hoping that as SUs, we can support that movement and higher education and FE education too. And it's just a shame to see them not prioritising anyone at all, especially when the voices of the people are screaming one thing and they're completely ignorant to that.
Mm. Yeah, so I guess one of the good pieces of news about November is that universities that haven't done that thing where when you enrol, you can pass your details onto the local electoral registration officer, can finally get their arse into gear and actually get that system in place. That would really help for those people responsible for that are listening this week. But I mean, interestingly, Hannah, you know, you live in a seat which has been dominated by the Tories for a while, actually. And I guess surely there must be some sense that there might be a chance of political change, not just because that party isn't doing very well this year, but because Lincoln's student population continues to grow.
Well, Lincoln's student population is huge in the grand scheme of the city. What sometimes frustrates me is that, so the city was tiny and then the student population grew, and that's what fuels most of the economy. So I would really hope, in kind of the same way, that the student population would turn out to vote and be able to do something about that. I think I would echo Lily. I really think youth needs to vote. Like, it worries me that people aren't necessarily as politically active as they used to be. It's just so important to vote. It's so important to make your voice heard. And if you don't do that, there's not much we can do.
But let me ask you both this, right? So it's normally at this time before an election, I mean, not that kind of snap election we had in 2019, right? But normally at this point in an election cycle, you'll have already had endless prospective parliamentary candidates phoning you up going, can I come and do a talk to students? Can I come and engage? Have you had much of that so far? The biggest student seat, you know, the most dominated, you know, most dominated by student seat in the country in Sheffield Central. Sheffield Central. Have you heard from any of the candidates yet?
Candidates, no. We actually have quite a good relationship traditionally anyways with them. So yeah, we are in regular conversation. But in terms of the next general election, we've heard nothing. There's constant engagement with a lot of the different institutions that we've got in Sheffield, the other university, Sheffield Hallam, as well as other Sheffield College and other institutions. But apart from that, there's been no progress in relation to this whatsoever. Just constant, the usual routine, which is still proactive and heard by our local politicians and councillors. And that's being developed, but definitely nothing new.
Mm. Yeah.
No, to my knowledge, I've had nothing personally, and I don't know, I don't think anyone's been in touch with us at all.
Just shocking, really. I mean, you know, how about in Durham, Gary?
Actually, our MP is very coordinated, and the thing you've got to remember about Durham is it is traditionally a very safe seat, despite the boundary changes. And I sort of think the uncertainty about the election means that people are sort of in a still doing the work role. Mm. You know, Rishi is trying to send off, I haven't said anything, why are you looking eager, vibes. And so there is an extent to which people are still just trying to do the job. I do think, though, that we've got to remember in the policy agendas, to riff off Lily a little bit, that you can see students in migration. It's just not good. Mm. You know, what the Home Office is, the policy agenda in the Home Office currently is not good for family, students with families, not good for students generally. You can see students in economic policy in the sense of jobs, but the minimum wage is not good for people who are under 21. You can see them in voter ID and the way that is excluding people. So I think students are in the agenda, but I think there is an active, well, let's say, a willingness to ignore evidence that that is causing harm. So I think actually mobilising is absolutely the right conversation to be having and getting people ready, because the, is it Section C conditions around voter registration that OFS regulate universities for? We can't start thinking about them in October. you know, I mean, universities are famously very agile and fast when it comes to decision making and planning. So I think, you know, we've got to be having those conversations now.
What else, Gary? What else have we not looked forward to?
It's all about the money, Jim. I think there's lots of, we're talking about the future and post-general election and offer for settlement, but we've got money issues now. I think what's most on my mind is that the marking and assessment boycott is in the post-mortem. The Commons Education Committee, government are talking about learning the lessons or whatever can be learned from that. But we are still in a situation where, as with trains, as with border force, as with the police, where governments say, you're autonomous, you can make your money choices as you like, but we will control all of your income and your expenditure. And universities are ever seeing the unit resource decrease in real terms. You know, so the economic news that Rishi is looking at might be hopeful. You know, we've got a budget tempting us to believe there's a May election. There's inflation forecasts released in this week from the Bank of England. But money, there is no money in the sector, but an increasing expectation of delivery. So I'm mostly looking forward to seeing what happens and hoping that too many people don't get harmed in the mathematics not quite working.
And, you know, I mean, both of you, Lily and Hannah, I mean, you know, there are open days on, right? Presumably at senior level, both of your universities, to one degree or another, are looking at the Excel sheet thinking, blimey, this is getting tight. And presumably there aren't loads of banners up on the open day going, well, here's what it looks like today, but it might not look like this by the end of your third year.
I think there's a lot of different changes that are going on across the board with a lot of universities, especially with the structures that they're doing at Sheffield. We're currently going through a restructure process and what that's going to look like and the promises that are being made to students and what the education is going to be, even from my own experience, changed drastically. And the rights of students in that position are unknown because they're controlled by the university again, or at least the support systems in order to know what they are controlled by the university. So I think there's a lot that is going to change. We know demographics are going to change vastly. PGT students, PGR students, as well as international student populations are going to change. It's going to completely affect the cities these universities are in. And I don't think there's any expectation of what that's going to look like and no planning ahead to support those students as well.
Yeah. And Hannah, I guess it's interesting, isn't it? Because we're in Finland where, you know, higher education is free, where if you know, a government gets elected and, you know, halves the funding for universities, to some extent, it's kind of tough luck, isn't it? But for students in, you know, actually around the UK, apart from, you know, home domiciled students in Scotland that stay in Scotland, for everyone else, they're being kind of sold an experience that meets a certain standard and it might not pan out like that.
Yeah. So obviously, while student fees are fixed, which is in the best interest of students, that's not changing the income of universities. So, so students are paying the same and they're not necessarily going to be receiving the same experience. So I'll absolutely echo what Lily said with the demographic of students. We're going to have so many more PGT, PGR students coming in because the money is in research. So the demographic of student populations is going to completely change, and are the resources there? Are universities geared up to be able to take on that demographic of students and give them what they expect?
Now, on Sunday, we met up with the president of Vilnius University Students' Union in Lithuania. Livia had a chat over some noodles.
So we're in Lithuania today with Liana from Vilnius University Student Representation. We've been talking about a lot of interesting things, but Liana, if I had to kind of ask you, if you could kind of fix one problem at the minute, what would it be?
I believe Ministries of Defence, Law on Defence, and inclusion of students and youth in the defence mechanism.
Yeah. Okay, so what is, could you explain a little bit about what that law is? Because that is very new, a lot of kind of defence words that has probably be quite, for a lot of our listeners, thinking, what on earth has that got to do with students and student unions at the minute?
So basically, according to the new law, or at least the draft that just is coming to the Parliament of Lithuania, students would have to mandatory enter the service when they study in and work at the service from Saturday to Sunday for 9 months. So basically that means that universities should stop their study process that is happening right now at many universities in Lithuania for many study programs on Saturdays, and students wouldn't be able to continue their study process. So this is a huge problem, and for universities and for students too, because they have to stop their study process basically to just because they have to mandatory enter the service.
And the trainings.
So they would have to go, they would still have to study Monday to Friday. And then they'd have to go to basically train in for the like military defense on a weekend?
Yes, absolutely. So they basically wouldn't have any left day off from studies or from trainings. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Karl Hämeri. I'm the chancellor of the University of Helsinki. And contrary to the UK universities, the chancellor is an academic leader. So I'm a professor as a background, and that's how I look the things I'm active on.
Oh, wow, that is quite different from some of our vice chancellors. The thing that I wanted to ask is, what is one thing that you think UK universities could learn from either the University of Helsinki or Finnish universities more generally?
That's a very good question, because usually the question is asked the other way around, because UK being a bigger country and in more many senses a leader in the Europe in terms of universities and the whole university sector. But I must say that Finland has, in my point of view, some strengths. One being that I think the balance between the governmental support and other support from foundations, private persons, private foundations, private companies. I think the balance is maybe, from our point of view, better. We are responsible for the government on what we're doing. The students will be helping the government overall. And therefore, the government takes the most responsibility funding the universities. But we have to be, in order to be successful, we have to be very active in fundraising, in external funding in general. And I think we have more or less a good balance at the moment.
I mean, we visited the University of Helsinki and we were really impressed with the value of education that in Finland as a whole, the way that the public really values education, but also the way that the university engages with students. It's so embedded in the core of what the university does. How do you, like, as chancellor or with the staff that you oversee, how do you feel that the university works well with students and student unions generally?
Well, first of all, I think the university is us, all of us, the staff, the leaders of the university, and the students. So we are like one community with different roles. The students are absolutely not our customers. Our customer is, if you want to put it that way, is the Ministry of Education, who is funding us. But the students are part of the community. So we work very closely with the students. And in my role, I think it's important to meet the students frequently, all the time. Of course, the leaders of the student unions, that's very important part of my new duty. Also, we have very strong nations. I don't know if you have this concept, but students coming from different geographical areas of Finland, they form nations and they have their history, they have their annual celebrities, and I want to participate, and the university staff and leaders participate their activities frequently. So you have to have an ongoing communication all the time to make the barrier very low, to really let the students who come and go, let them feel that they are part of the community, even if they stay only a few years compared to us.
Now, next up this week, we've published some stuff on sleep, Lily.
Yeah, on the site, we've been looking at the effect of sleep on students. We found relationships between life satisfaction rapidly dropping and anxiety levels rapidly accelerating. And it showed that students got an average of 5.4 hours a night, which I can confirm seems pretty accurate to me. the connection there between academic performance, mental health, even your own physical health as well, is just so drastic. And it plays such a massive role in how you experience university, both in life outside of it and within it. It was looking at the importance of that and the connection to your outcomes.
Now,
Hannah, should we worry about this? Surely, you know, you're students, you know, they're out partying, you know, all the cliches. Does it really matter this?
Well, it's like you said, it's a stereotype, isn't it, that students don't sleep, they're always out partying. But I think cost of living crisis, students are so time poor, they're working, they're getting up, they're going to university, they're going to work, they're getting their 3, 4, 5 hours, and then they're getting up and doing it all over again. So it's something that should definitely be thought about, just in terms of keeping students sane, really.
What should we do about this, Gary? I mean, you know, I mean, what do we do? Start lectures at 11 a.m? I mean, you know, this.
Well, I think there's quantity and quality arguments in this. And I think I'm really pleased that where I work at Durham University, we sort of got into the data and engaged with this conversation a couple of years ago in our student wellbeing strategy. Started doing research and actions around student sleep quite a few years ago, actually. I think it's part of a broader progressive woke nonsense agenda around recognising that people are humans in the same way that conversation around menopause or around fertility and that sort of stuff are things that actually we just have to go, people do this. Like they sleep. Sleep is affected by things and it affects outcomes. I do think it is a thing that can be subject to policy conditions. Of course it can. Some of which we can control in universities, some of which are broader in the world. I think we have got to be thinking about timing of practical activities. But I was fascinated this week. I had a conversation with an exec director at Tampere University who said that actually, you know, that they're in the land of the midnight sun. And actually they get like 4 hours of sunlight at some point and it affects mood. And then they get part of the year when they get nothing but dark and their face moved in a different way and they can't sleep, and it's fascinating. So I do think universities are famously clever places. This research is a really good start to thinking about easy interventions. Top of my list, if I was going to do anything, it is actually about 24-hour libraries. I believe they are a harm. I absolutely would stop people being, like we fetishise 3 o'clock in the morning essay writing. Like, stop it. Do things around assessment time, around assessment length, around assessment format that don't require people to do competitive sleeplessness.
I'll tell you the bit that I thought was really interesting, Lily, right? So when I was going through the numbers last weekend, obviously we kind of know that lots of students are in part-time work, right? Mm-hmm. Of course we know that, yeah? And we know that public transport's all over the place, particularly post-Brexit. You know, lots of bus companies are having problems with, you know, staffing their buses and so on. And we also know that lots of students are not actually particularly close to city centres. You know, they're having to live kind of further and further out in some cases. But, where you look at some stats and you go, well, of course that's true. And actually the thing that really, and I put this in the blog, is, of course, the more that students are working in part-time jobs, the more their average travel time is a week. And of course that makes sense, because if you're traveling an hour to a shift and then an hour back, and you've got four shifts across the course of 4 weeks, that's lots of extra hours that you're adding in on travel time. And I guess, you know, that surely must be a worry that there are some students who don't really need the money and are kind of fine and maybe, you know, got the odd shift somewhere, maybe once a week. And then there are other students, and, you know, if they're working sort of 31 to 35 hours a week, on average, that add in another sort of 8 hours travel time per week, there's not a lot of many hours left to do anything else, is there?
I know. I think at the moment, especially with the fees and the costs that we're having at university, students are trying to squeeze out as much of the activity as they can. And in order to do that, at the moment with rising costs and inflation, you have to pay more. So in order to have the experience that you were once promised, that you saw, that you dreamed of when you wanted to, let's say, go to university, you now have to do a lot more in order to get there. And to see people who are able to afford that, and the idea is the image that you are sold is the people who can afford to go out every couple of nights. They can go and have a meal or have a drink or do whatever they wish to do, take part in that society, do this every day. And you're sold that as the norm. And I think that's where we go wrong. And not everyone also wants to do that, but there's an expectation that you have to live up to that standard of living. And I think it sets this terrible precedent that going on past university, that this is supposed to be how your work-life balance is managed. Yeah. And a work-life balance like this, you have no time to rest, to stop, breathe for a second. Because in order to be able to do the importance of your teaching and your expectations of studies outside of your classes and seminars and labs and whatever that you do study, you then have to put in twice the amount of effort outside of it, and especially with the travel costs as well, with those rising. And that being such a barrier for participation for a lot of students, I think there's such this pressure put on the student population at the moment that they have to live up to this ideology that we have.
Yeah. And potentially will blame themselves if they can't kind of hit that.
The guilt that you feel, yes.
Yeah.
I think you've got to bear in mind that there are very many students who are required to travel. So I think one of the unintended policy consequences around health reorganisation, teaching organisation, those things where actually placements and the catchment areas for placements are so large and complex that actually students don't get to opt out of that. It's not like, you know, for listeners who wonder that students could work closer, isn't there a super drug within a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
But actually people who are on medical courses or teaching courses or nursing or all those sorts of professionals, people who are doing business courses on sandwich years, have to be able to move. And actually that brings in housing costs, it brings in transport costs, and it brings in time, and that brings in sleep. You know, you can be based in Sheffield and have a medical placement in Derby. It's crackers.
Yeah. I mean, look, Hannah, the naughty thing is to call your job VP fun, right? But I mean, a vice president activities in a student union is thinking a lot about student development and extracurricular activities. And, you know, we've certainly seen a lot of kind of examples of students engaged in different sorts of extracurricular activities in both kind of relatively poor nations and relatively rich nations, actually, across the course of the week. But it's really hard, isn't it, at the moment for some students to even consider getting involved in some of that stuff when they've got so many other of these kind of burdens.
Yeah, it's huge. So when you're talking about student engagement, one thing that I keep harping on about to everybody is that students are so time poor. So we're out and we're preaching to students like, you should join your academic society, you should go play sports, you should do varsity, you should play books. And students just don't have the time. And it's where then priorities overlap. What are they supposed to pick? And they're obviously picking their studies, but some students aren't able to and they have to pick the work. And it just becomes a massive, massive problem. Because like I said earlier, people are getting up, they're studying, they're going to uni, they're going straight to work. And then when them students are engaged in their extracurricular activities, they are not sleeping. There's no time left over.
Yeah.
I know.
Gary, there are things that could help, aren't there? I mean, yeah, as ever, with almost every problem in higher education, it's easy to go, oh God, don't blame universities again for this. But there are some things that universities can do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think the underappreciated fact in terms of student commitment is they want to do well. I mean, that sounds like a daft thing to say, but if I start there, then of course they want to commit time and then sleep and effort. So when you are in charge of the things they have to do well at, you do have a responsibility, I think, to reflect upon how you organise that and what you do. I think 24-hour libraries are the bane of my life. I've never believed in them. But there are some things around how you incentivise alcohol, of course. But I really think it's easy to focus on the fun stuff because people see people doing it. You know, that is out in the public. Mm. But actually, the sleeplessness is generally people's bedrooms. I think that Wonky has done some brilliant research and engaged in some discussions around loneliness and people engaging online communities. And actually, that affecting things which is around time difference and asynchronous communications. And I think there's a well-published and well-discussed agenda around how you combat that with other forms of thinking thing. The route for me is to mean to do it. Mm. So that's why I'm particularly pleased that Durham SU and Durham University are thinking about sleep and how it affects well-being, because it is a relevant factor. So it's affected by lots of things. I suppose the headline assumption is to factor it, I think, for me, into assessments around whether disabled people, that is a particular factor when people engage in any other form of assessment for support. So if somebody enters for money support or healthcare support or disabled support, understanding that that is a relevant factor to consider when that comes up. And, you know, all of our student support professionals are trying to get under the skin of what's presented. And I think that is, this research suggests that would be a really useful thing to start talking about. Because of this, can I ask you how it impacts?
Yeah.
That feels like a really easy thing to do.
Yes. Now, Lily, look, you know, whinging Jim, moaning about the sector all of the time, I think would say, you know, this is the year, folks, to get that timetabling system sorted. And this really is the year to put your back into a proper strategy for maximising the number of part-time jobs that students are able to access near to campus, you know, kind of big projects. But the other thing I overuse a lot, right, is I can't remember if I've said it on the podcast before, but a few months ago, I was reading one of the free text comments in one of our surveys, and a student said that coming to campus is like going to the cinema on your own, right? And I thought what was really kind of interesting about that is that I figure that, you know, in the next few weeks, it's January, a bunch of new modules will start in a new semester. And some of those modules will start with students kind of getting to know each other and some group activities and students being taught in a way that causes them at least to spend some time with other students when they're actually on campus. And I guess there are other students who will enroll onto some modules this semester and they won't really get to spend much time with other students or engaging with other students. And, you know, that sort of, just that really small day-to-day stuff about what academic staff do really matters too, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think it's learning to collaborate with people in a lot of different ways and settings. And this is coming from someone myself. I would be the person who walked into a lecture theatre and depending on the day, I'd go and start a conversation with a brand new person or I'd sit down on my own and get on with my work. And it completely depended on that. And that didn't mean that you still didn't have those interactions in other settings, whether it was societies or just out and about in the city. And I definitely think there's an importance of making sure that we're seeing university as a development, a personal development for life after university and not just an academic growth mechanism. And I think that's something that the university per se might not be utilizing as much as it can be, the skills that you can develop through societies. And we should be engaging in those more as a sector and making sure that we're rewarding those for partaking in those activities. Because when you look at a massive form of loads of different CVs in the future, a recruiter isn't going to go, oh, you've all got the same thing. They're going to spot the thing that you did outside of the box, the new thing that you didn't have to do. And I think we as universities and SUs should be pushing students to engage in those activities more.
Yeah.
But with the time crunch that we've got at the moment and people feeling and needing to have part-time jobs, there's just less incentive to want to do any of that.
Yes. And Hannah, look, one of the things that really struck me earlier, I don't know about you, you know, we often say, and actually Lily just said, you want to be able to say that you've done things outside of your course, right? But of course, we have seen some models this week, haven't we, where students are able to gather academic credit for what we traditionally in the UK regard as extra to your course, but actually are very much regarded in all, you know, to some extent in all of the countries we've been to as core to the educational experience and therefore attracting academic credit. And therefore, students have got time to do it.
Yeah. So there's been some really, really interesting models. It's fascinating. It's something I came away today really thinking about. It's fascinating to look at and how we could facilitate that. I think it's difficult where, like you say, students are so time poor, they're having to pick one or the other. But honestly, I think it all comes back around to money. It's how are students funding themselves? How are students feeding themselves? How are they paying their rent? It's, for me, all about cost of living and how students are affording to survive. Pre-COVID, I don't necessarily think it was so much of an issue. Obviously, now it's huge. So if there was some way that things could be rewarded with academic credit or even monetary, I know it's huge, but it would just change the way students live completely.
Mm. And, you know, one other thing that kind of flows off that, Gary, the kind of food thing here in Finland. Yeah. I mean, you know, there is not a chance in the kind of economy we have with the kind of tax system we have that we're about to get food to be subsidised to the extent it is in, you know, Finland, right? You know, people aren't going to be able to go in and have their lunch every day for €3 and it meeting sustainability standards and be nutritious and so on. But you know, for me, one of the things that's been interesting about being in Finland is not just how cheap having a lunch on campus is. It's why it's cheap on campus. Mm-hmm. Eating well and being healthy as a result of what you put in your stomach is part. You know, people understand here the relationship between eating and health and your overall development and your ability to succeed and so on. And, you know, I get the sense that sometimes the people that are organising and renegotiating those contracts in the UK might have a couple of sustainability presentations that they can give to border governors. But apart from that, it's getting the money.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely. I think I broadly agree with you that you can't see it happening in the UK if you imagine the only source of subsidy is government or institutions.
Mm.
One of the great things about, I think, what we've seen in Finland is that students are doing it for themselves.
Mm.
In that because of historical circumstance, you know, they seem to own most of Helsinki. in terms of land. And it's genuinely interesting, listeners, in terms of being granted land hundreds of years ago and then the city centre moving and it acquiring value. It's a really fascinating story. But they're choosing to invest the profits not in shinier facilities or more marketing or, you know, hoodies or whatever. They're subsidising, as you say, Jim, social good. Now, absolutely not getting into food bullying at all. I think when I understand like good eating and healthy eating, it's about doing it in companies, it's about doing it regularly, it's about being able to do it cheaply around your studies. So we've had a lovely vegan meal in one of their restaurants this afternoon, which would normally be €2.95 subsidised. And we spoke to the chief executive organisation that provides it. And students do it, you know, a couple of meals a day because it is available, it is local. They've got 16 across Helsinki. It's brilliant. I think the fascinating side benefits of that to me is that they talk about being a leader in the field of sustainability. So in terms of where they procure their products, they haven't sold a beef for 7 years, I think it was. Every meal doesn't have its calories and bullying people in that way, but it does have its carbon offset. So you can make choices based upon that. And it is good food. I think one of the traditions, which apparently comes from Sweden that has moved over, is, I'm going to get this wrong, sitkas, which is the benefit of eating in company and talking and sharing that sort of thing. You know, it's something we see a lot of places like Durham, actually, in that benefit of decompression, thinking, being able to do that in company, combating loneliness and talking about your course. So I think if you think about where you've got that, I mean, spare money, who's got that? But if you think about where you choose to invest your money, they've invested it in students being well and not facilities to enable them to extrapolate profit to then put into services to do well. It's keeping it where the wellness is generated, not assuming that I will make you all more well if you trust me, but you need to give me your service.
Yeah.
It's just such a fascinating trust in people being able to do that themselves.
Now, on Monday, we saw the president of the Latvian Students' Union, Lina Levada. Here's what she had to say.
So one of the big things that's going to happen in the next 3 years is we're refurbishing our financing system, because now we have like the money follows the student, to the student follows the money. You know, we each stated funds. Like right now, the ministry signs the agreement with the higher education institutions about how many state-funded places are going to be in which program, which is quite, you know, it's not very... The flexibility is not great. And now we're moving towards like the kind of a lump sum funding that the ministry gives like a sum of money, and then the university decides what does they want to do with it, how many state-funded places, how many fee places and stuff like that. And of course, well, we'll see.
That's very interesting.
They're going to, in the agreement, we haven't seen that we're going to have a pilot project right now in the technical university year.
Yeah.
To see if
there are downsides and if
what's going to happen. Yeah. But there are going to be things put into the agreement. I mean, but you know, it's not like technical university can just close all of its engineering programs. for example, there are going to be some, I think, outcomes. Like you need to have around this many alumni of this. Graduates in this field, but we're waiting because us as a student union, it's also important of us to see the general requirements, because pilots usually become regulation.
What else?
We're moving towards the institutional accreditation of the higher education institutions, because right now, once you get the institutional accreditation, you can be in university forever if you don't. Like nobody checks whether, like, we have like in study field accreditation, which is a very weird system. All of the international experts who come for accreditation are. What is this? But you know, like most of the Europe, they have like institutional accreditation every 5 to 7 years. But we're very slow on the implementation of that, on the regulation and all of that stuff, because of capacity problems in the governmental sector.
I've got one other question.
Yeah.
The agreement on international student recruitment.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did that come about? You know, because clearly I was reading this one, deals with agents and.
What do you mean?
With support. It's like you've got an agreement between universities to improve international student recruitment.
We have the. Good practice in attracting the international students. I think it's the first one was signed, I don't know, it's been a while, because like we've been having internationals since the 90s. We also, of course, it's not, we also have our bad apples. We have our private universities who are kind of a diploma mills, who are just cash grabbing from internationals. And institutional accreditation is supposed to also get rid of them. But we're also like, trying to work towards doing an extraordinary accreditation in them if we get enough, you know, students complaints about it, because there have been some very problematic cases of they just taking the money, but the studies were supposed to be face to face, but they're taking the money and the studies are in Zoom, and probably you know the same thing. And the good practice is it's a non-binding thing. You sign it, and they have a whole committee. They see the data on whether you're still doing the good thingies. It's quite a quality symbol for international students. It does exist. We would love it for it to be like legally binding, you know, for everyone, but baby steps.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas.
Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, so we are currently in Helsinki and we have met lots of interesting people today. Today we are currently with Akseli, who is an ex-SUL, which is the one of the national unions of Finland. So I'm going to kind of pass it over to Akseli to give us a little bit of a rundown about the current political environment and in student politics and wider Finnish politics.
Yeah, so first of all, it's a pleasure to be here. So my name is Akseli Rouvari. I work as a consultant these days with political related things, mostly green transition, but also higher education policy. And before that, my background is in student politics, especially. I think that I went into student politics and went through that route and was working in the National Union of University Students of Finland, so SUL, in the year 2021. I was working mostly with social policy, climate and environmental matters and communications. So I've been very involved with the Finnish student movement for a long time, and I think the student movement in Finland generally is very interesting and a benchmark, because students have quite a lot of power in the Finnish system. Student politics is kind of a big thing in here. And then again, for example, we have lots of ex-politicians, current politicians who are ex-people coming from the student movement. So I could say maybe 50% of the people that are working in politics might even have some kind of background in student politics. So that's really interesting. Actually, our current Prime Minister, Petteri Orpo, was the General Secretary of SUL, I think, something like 25 years ago. So even those kinds of people have a student policy background. So that's also a thing that highlights the influence of students in the Finnish society.
Is that going to be you in a few years' time then, since you're going to go and be Prime Minister soon? One of the things that we were chatting about earlier was about how the politicians are really actually quite keen to listen to student views. And part of that, I think, from what I've gathered, and correct me if I'm wrong, is because of their background in student politics, they're often kind of, right, well, what would benefit students in this way? And to put it bluntly, that is quite the opposite sometimes. At least at the moment, it feels like that in UK politics. And you were telling us a little bit about the campaign that you helped run around student mental health and that kind of thing. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, if possible?
Yeah, for sure. So I think that in general, students are well received in the Finnish society, or student life is quite bright and colorful in many ways. There's lots of things you can do, and that's also a thing why even the older generations, many of the politicians have a fondness towards students, and they've been in the position themselves, and they've been working in student politics. So that's kind of a big thing why many people are eager also to understand the point of view, because they remember their own time and they have some empathy towards the position that students are in now. Especially the mental health thing, I think that was the biggest single thing that we were advocating for when I was in SUL 3 years ago. So the student mental health crisis has been has been a continuous topic during the last years here, and especially when the corona crisis started, it was highlighted in many surveys and researches. Some researchers were even saying that 2/3 of the students in the University of Helsinki were having some kind of symptoms of feeling burned out or feeling their mental health getting worse. So I think those issues have been very highlighted in the society. So we actually did a big advocacy campaign during that year. We have 2,000 members in the Parliament of Finland, and I met over half of those during that year to discuss about these matters. And I was especially in charge when I was doing social policy. My special highlight was on the financial situation of students, because we have lots of researchers, lots of current statistics that show that because there has been cuts to the funding of Finnish student benefits, the money that Finnish students get, those are very much correlated with the mental health situation of Finland. So when we have cuts and when people have more stress over their financial situation, their mental health goes worse. So I think that was something that we were trying to highlight, and we were trying to get the decision makers to understand that even though it costs money to invest to the student benefits now, it also it's an important thing, because it will cost society even more money in the future if the people are going to be burnt out when they get out of the university, when they go to working life. They're not going to be as efficient. We're going to have a rise of people being off work because of mental health reasons, people being not able to work because of mental health reasons. So I think that's a part of the economic policy discussion that we were trying to bring forward, and I think we had some good success in many ways, because politics is always a marathon, not a sprint. So it takes time to get some changes across. And actually, last year, 2023, when we had the new government, then basically in the government program, they made the decision to implement this system called the guaranteed therapy for all the youth in Finland, so people under 30. So that was a big thing we advocated for during that year, and it didn't happen that year, but it is in the government program now, even though the government is quite right wing. They adopted that because they understand that the mental health crisis is a bad thing. So I think that was something to be proud of, and I'm happy that we could get that across, even though I'm still frustrated that many of the other things we haven't gotten across. For example, regarding the students' financial situation, it hasn't been getting any better. But small victories are also important ones.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've seen similar research in the UK that, you know, students being worried about financial costs really does impact their well-being and their ability to perform well. I think one thing we've all been, like, shocked and absolutely fascinated by is the value that Finnish society and the government in particular seems to really put in education, and particularly higher education. It feels really valued and celebrated. Like there's a student day in May, I think I'm right in saying, and that feels really, really foreign to us actually. Could you tell us a little bit about maybe why you think that is? Is that a long tradition, or is that something that's been fairly new?
Yeah, I think generally, as I said, the Finnish student life is very lifeful, very, very bright in many ways, and there's lots of things going on, and students are an important part of this society. And I think in Finland, the education has always been the cornerstone of our country, the building block that we have had our best economic innovations, our best companies, or the biggest things we have contributed to the world are usually somewhat related to the educational system. So that's been something that we've been focusing on. And I think the respect towards students in the whole society is a big part of that thing. So we understand that for us to thrive in the future, we need to invest in education. We need to have people who are valued parts of the society. So I think that's been an important thing in Finland. Of course, we have had some situations where there has been budget cuts to education in the past because of the economical situations, but I think it's widely understood at this time that that's not the way forward. So only giving more resources to education and highlighting the need for educational for our educational system to thrive is the important way for us to, forward in the future too. So yeah,
I think for us in Britain is that universities and the higher education institutions really value education, but beyond that in public life it's kind of less so. But brilliant, thank you so much for chatting to us today, Axeli. It's been fab meeting you.
And finally, right, so what else, Hannah, have you had your mind blown by this week?
I don't even know where to start, honestly. So this week we've been to a few countries. We've spoken to loads and loads of higher education institutions, student activities, student unions, about what they've been up to. and what they're looking at going forwards. So we've spoken to fraternities, sororities. I don't even know where to begin with it. I've had my mind blown.
Gary, you've been on a couple of these. Anything stand out this time around?
Yeah. Whenever I come on these, what absolutely fascinates me is the thoughtfulness of the places. Like, they're not ostentatious or difficult, but they do put something in front of you, which is go, I understand you and what you think is important. So we're at the University of Helsinki today, and one that they just had a slide going, oh, here's some marketing, and our host was going, I need to tell you this, it's about the university. But one of their values was Bildung. I didn't know what that word was. I Googled it live, and it's a German philosophy that I'm going to absolutely misrepresent. It's about education which grows the social being. Like, it's not about materialist education per se, you know, and that I'm not having to go on that, that has its use, but it's about going, we grow the whole person here. Now, it occurs to me that, no shade on any UK university, but we are generic. We also say we are distinctive, we are different from the others come to us, but also our values are considerate and
exactly the same
sustainability, possibly funds in there. But this place said, I've got an educational philosophy, and it is about whole person growth and learning. I suppose, not to fit two in one and that whole thing, but I've also been really interested to hear about how they describe themselves as young nations, that philosophy, because of the history of this part of the world, which is fascinating. And in Estonia and Latvia, what really fascinated me from the sororities that were mentioned, and I think we're going to come on to in a bit, was they spoke about patriotism. Like, Student Society said, it is our job to make being Estonian something that people think is good. Actually, I am older than the current state of Estonia. Like, and they view it as something to be cherished. Like, it is something to promote. And their student societies aren't just about fun, although that's got its place, or functional skill development. It's about who is going to cherish this place going forward if we don't. So I just think they, in all the countries we've seen, we have seen a philosophy that isn't stuffy, but is lived. And then you go home, and we're the best one in the world. Like, I think we miss that. Like, I don't know why we think we're doing these things.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I don't know about you, Lily, right? But one of my reflections on the week is, whenever I kind of roam around campuses in the UK, there's always a load of stuff about the past. Like, this is how old we are. Look, this is how far the university dates back. You know, we've got a long, proud history, blah, blah, blah. You're kind of obsessed with the past. Like, the country is obsessed with the past. But there's a hell of a lot of kind of looking to the future here, isn't there?
Yeah, I definitely think that's something that we were talking about today, the progression of a lot of these institutions, even the oldest of them, which predate a lot of our institutions back home. And I think it's that connectivity between both the local community and the government here, and the respect for students as well, that links everyone together. I think that's such a community that we are all supporting one another, especially with the models that we've seen here, where they have universities and universities of applied sciences, which completely prepare students of any kind for the labour environment of the specifically here in Helsinki. And that completely changes and adapts with what is happening. And I think we're quite stuck in our ways back home, and we aren't as progressive, but we have the potential to be. And I don't think we look at models like this. I think it was slightly different when we were in the likes of Lithuania and looking at those kind of models and what they have in terms of the patriotism there and the want to kind of gather and support each other in the community that they now are able to have. And I think that was completely vastly different from what we see now in Finland, which was what I would say a lot more progressive. But it's definitely interesting to see how universities and SUs and the government interact with one another. I found that very drastic from what we have back home. I think there's a lot of assumption that you're in this antagonistic relationship with the university in a really positive way where you're challenging one another. But here it was more of a teamwork, a collaboration. And I got the sense that universities saw the power and potential of students' unions as lobbying tools, as progressive generators of students for the many generations to come to progress the country. And it was a different thing than we see now. I think there's somewhat a rhetoric back home where the voices of these, whether extreme views, as some may say, are being shut down. Whereas we should be harnessing them and letting those kind of conversations, and whether they are antagonistic or not, they're progressive in some way or another, and they help you to develop your own personal opinion on things. And I think that's where the frustration is happening back home, was not seeing the want from universities to expand our views. And that's what you expect from higher education and FE education. And it's just been so fantastic to see that it can work here.
Now Hannah, in three of the four countries we've been to, students on university committees have a veto.
I was literally just about to talk about this.
But, I mean, you know, I was, because I kind of knew this, because, you know, I kind of done some of this before. And I was kind of looking around the room when it each time it happened. And I think people's assumption is that that must automatically mean it's been used several times and there have been massive big blow-ups. But it's kind of interesting that all of them said they barely ever happened.
Yeah, students here are viewed as such an integral part of the system and just the population as a whole. And local government and national government really think about students when they make decisions. And I don't necessarily think that that is something that we have in the UK. I think some institutions have some really good relationships with their local government and their councils. But the students here, that veto right is so important because it just shows that they're given due thought when processes are being made. And the fact that they've not had to use it so much is amazing because it shows that the government are actually doing their diligence when it comes to students and what students want and what students need, because students are such a huge part of our economy, of our demographic. And the students here are proud of their education, so it goes both ways, I think. And I don't know if that's necessarily something we're lacking a little bit. Students here are so proud of where they come from and where they studied. And they really care about their local government and they feed into it. It's been fascinating.
Tell you the other thing I think is really interesting, Gary, right? Even the kind of full-time student representatives that are sort of, going to the big university committees and so on, they always talk about their subject, right? Mm. They talk a lot about this. You know, they're a geographer or they study business, whatever, and so on. And I don't get much of a sense of that in the UK. Am I talking to the wrong people?
No, I mean, I think one of the things which listeners might not know is it's really easy to read some research, some commentary. You know, I'm thinking about some of the works by Rachel Brooks or by Villa Rafa at Durham about student unions and student activism. I think they're apples for apples. But actually, in Europe, student unions don't do societies. They don't do commercial trading. You know, there's good historical reasons for that, but actually, they conceive themselves as intrinsically linked between students as people who study and university decision-making bodies. So therefore, of course, they'd organise around departments, around courses. Like the other stuff that we would recognise in the UK around social groups and around being able to buy meals from each other, as I've spoken about before, does exist, but they're not in the same body. Like it's not a single organisation that delivers those like the UK. Now, I'm going to go back and think about what does that mean? You know, that's the purpose of these trips. You're not meant to copy and paste. It's a reflective conversation. But I do think what I've seen here in terms of the benefits of departments or academic units, you know, that sort of thing, is that they use it as a basis for culture building, what we would probably call induction. But if you call it induction here, you're not getting the half of it because that kills it. It's like putting a butterfly in a case. It's like, that's not the point of it. Like they do it for themselves and teach each other the behaviours and the cultures and the skills and the tips and tricks of their unit. They do the overalls, the coveralls that we mentioned previously, and wear badges. And none of their badges are about skills or competition. You know, I've checked. I've asked a lot of questions about that because it fascinates me. They're just about turning up. Like, if you are here, we want to recognise it. If you've come, we want to say, well done for coming. Please come again. What was fascinating, I suppose, just a bit aside, is they absolutely have a culture of questioning quite seriously curriculum, assessment methods, teaching delivery, like what we would call the business of a board of study. But again, like a butterfly, if you take it to a board of study, it dies. Like with them, it's live. Like it's a conversation that I think in the UK we have an impression that we need to start students talking about their education. That otherwise they're like sitting in the cupboard or just talking about tequila or something. And they're never talking about teaching or the quality of the library or that sort of stuff. They're doing it all the time. Like we need to listen. Like student voice is becoming a phrase I'm really hating. I'm thinking more about like institutional ears. Whereas actually here it is natural. It feels like something that is happening all the time, and if you create the system for it, you're not getting the point. You actually just need to be there.
That's interesting. I think the other thing I was thinking on the bus the other day, Lily, right, is there's a lot of individuals in the UK, and what I mean by that is, you know, there's a student union officer or there's a faculty rep or a course rep, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think is kind of interesting in, to some extent, all four countries is you rarely hear people talking about a person, right? Mm. You will hear people talking about a board or an association or a chapter or a guild or whatever. There are lots of kind of groups. Like the sense is that what you have to do is get people together in a sort of cooperative way to kind of look after each other and serve each other and so on. Whereas in the UK, there's, do you want to be a rep or do you want to go and there's one person for you and so on and so on. And I don't know, is that something we could change? Is that just British? I mean, you know, what is it because this bit of Europe is much better at voluntary sector and associative activity? I don't know.
I think it comes with perhaps the level of trust within a university and its students' union as well.
And us feeling like we have to appoint specific reps for this and that, and you can't be this, and you're a tutor here, and you're an academic rep here, and you represent these people here. And realistically, it's just the want to completely represent people. And I think Sheffield, we have fantastic student representation, and we get a lot of students turning up to council meetings and the democratic systems that we have, and it's fantastic. But even we're saying, okay, we overcomplicate it. You should be able to have influence in and we should be supporting and facilitating that as a body. I think there's been a movement of SUs having to take, and universities too with duty of care, having to take up a lot of different responsibilities that we once didn't have to do. And in terms of advocacy and lobbying, we've seen a lot of that here. And it's a completely different dynamic with a lot of the SUs here I've seen, especially when we were in Estonia. The SUs had responsibility for the experiences and the joy of a lot of the students. And it wasn't as much about the advocacy. That responsibility, because of the connection with the government, was reliant upon the national unions. And that was fantastic to see the channels that those could go through. But I think we're a completely different dynamic in the UK. And I'm not saying that in a bad thing. I love the amount of activism that we have on a local scale. And I think it's about seeing, okay, how can we take those incredible groups of student activists and amplify those voices and help to network and organize students across the country? Because we have so much of that. And I think I've seen the contrast between Europe. There's definitely pockets of it, and incredible pockets of it, who have a lot of power within the government as well, and that kind of influence and soft influence that we necessarily currently back home don't have. But I don't think we're utilizing what we do have in any way.
Now Hannah, I overuse this a lot, right? But one of my other reflections this week has been, if you open those Sunday supplements in August, right, it will say you're about to be thrown in at the deep end of higher education, right? And you might sink, you might swim, you know, blah, blah, this whole idea of being thrown in at the deep end. And these are pretty deep ends these days, right? You know, massive courses, massive cohorts, massive campuses. But one of the things I've found really interesting all week is that whenever I've kind of been sticking my hand up a bit too much, mm-hmm. I guess, but every time I've kind of asked about the new student experience, I've got a sense that what happens for new students is something really quite small, right? You know, they're in a team, or they're in a group, or they're being looked after by a tutor, a student tutor, or, you know, this sense that they get quite a kind of small introduction to student life, which is much more kind of human than transactional, really shines through, doesn't it?
I think the peer-to-peer network here is huge. That's something I've really, really noticed. So students spend a lot of time with peer-to-peer. So these associations kind of fall under their school that they're in. They're spending a lot of time with kind of almost the people that have gone before them, like their elders on their courses. And in the UK, we have peer-to-peer and it's amazing. But I think sometimes peer-to-peer gets lost when, particularly we have student leader teams all across the country that are amazing and we utilise them so much. But I think I will say this all the time, and I'm sure people are sick of me saying it, but what's the use of me preaching at people when I can get students to speak to each other? And I think the use of that student network is so important, and it's something we just forget sometimes. And it's just, it can be so powerful. I've seen here how powerful it can be.
Putting some scaffolding into it.
Yeah.
And I guess, Gary, you know, the other thing, as you know, I've overused for decades now, is banging on about the difference between a Broadway musical and a school play. Mm-hmm. You know, nine out of 10 Broadway musicals fail.
Yeah. My staff hate me talking about it now, because you talk about it. Yeah.
But school plays sell out. Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, we've seen some decent Broadway musicals this week, both in terms of some of the things that universities and student associations do. But we've seen a lot more school plays, haven't we?
Yeah, and we were, crikey, where was it? I can't remember. The name was Nora. She was brilliant.
The name was Nora.
She was at the front of the room. One of our group, the British people, said, what is it about Finnish people being so joyful? I think it was temporary. And she went, we don't know either, we just are. And I think you've probably heard from our conversation, like Liliana and me, that what we most talk is that people like doing what they're doing. Like, there's challenges, but they're not really stressed. And I reflect on that, you know, the school plays, is that people like paint, you know, at their spare time, paint scenery and like sew costumes and all that sort of stuff. They're not paid, and that's like, they're not particularly thanked. They just do it because they like it. They believe in it. It's nice. And I think what we've seen here is people who have joy in their work. I've said a few times, like, if they came to the UK, can you imagine what we would do? Like, we're just like, oh, there's not enough money. It's quite stressful. We don't like it. And it made me, I don't know, guilt, shame. I don't know. But I sort of reflect that in the UK, we whinge quite a lot. And actually, if you think about the size of our institutions with the resource they've got, like the academic quality, you know, the UK's academic quality across the world, what the punch, the weight we punch in research and teaching.
we have got it really, really well. Notwithstanding, you know, we've spoken about the general election and all that sort of stuff, we're doing pretty well in the UK. We are a Broadway musical, but acting like we're a horrible fire. and we're not, we're doing really well. And I think, yeah, we've seen brilliant school plays, and it's made me really just reflect on, oh, it's all right, actually.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Lily, Hannah, Gary, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week with a normal show. Until then, stay warm.